Taking a very different path to the rest of our guests, Stuart Hurst is an employee in an accountancy firm. But over the course of his remarkable career, Stuart has taken three different firms from a place of overservicing and undercharging their clients, putting them through some really strict processes to get them to be a really profitable firm with all their employees really engaged and having great reviews online. He's done this not once, but three times now. He knows exactly what it takes to get a firm from where it is stuck right now to where it needs to be. And in this episode, Stuart is going to tell you all the secrets behind the exact processes he went through to get every one of those firms from one place to the next. Stuart has been there and done this, and you will not get this level of knowledge anywhere else. Welcome to Firm Up, where you'll get the mindsets and practical tips to build an exceptional firm. Enjoy. Stuart, welcome.
Hello.
So you had a route into the accountancy world that's a bit different to a lot of our other guests in that you aren't necessarily an accountancy business owner, but you do run a lot of the operations in some big firms. So just tell me a little bit about your route into accountancy.
How far back do you want to go?
Start us right from the beginning. So what do we need to know from your childhood that got you there?
All right, where it all began with baby Stuart. So in terms of growing up, as a child, you know, a loving family, mum, dad, brother, younger brother, lots of love, but lots of stress, a lot, particularly around finances. And even as a 10-year-old child, I knew we had next to no money, like we were proper on the breadline. I mean, currently I'm wearing holes in my jeans now for fashion purposes and to be down with the kids and all that. But at the time, it was holes in trousers with patches on because we couldn't afford any others. Brother got all hand-me-downs in classic fashion, and it was tough in that sense. It was hard. My dad used to work. He ran a small decorating company, employing like 5-6 people. I don't remember. You know, he'd barely see him. He'd work almost every Saturday, Sundays sometimes as well. Like he was classic breadwinner, like trying to make ends meet. And even as a child, I remember seeing Santander bank statements with, or Abbey National as it was then, with like red numbers on them. Like even then as a young child, it was difficult. And then I didn't know it at the time, but when I was 14, like life changed forever. And that was the moment where, from an accounting perspective, everything would change for my career. Although obviously back then I didn't think so, but I was 14, my dad was 40, and he had a heart attack. And the doctor said, you know, he eats healthy, he gets plenty of exercise, he's up and down ladders, doesn't drink, doesn't smoke. But it's stress, and it was all stress about money and finances. So the doctors were quite shocked, to be honest, that he'd had that heart attack so young. And it was a critical one. Like, some people are in and out of hospital 2 weeks. He was in intensive care. And while he was there, his mum died. And we were told specifically, like, you cannot tell him his mum has died. It could kill him. Like, I mean, that was quite traumatic in its own right. And he came out, never got a chance to say goodbye to his mother, had an absolute mental breakdown, lost the business, felt like a failure, tried to kill himself. And for the next 7 years, like, battled particularly hard anxiety and depression. And for two of those years was sectioned, which was absolutely crazy as a child, like waving your dad off to a mental hospital. And I mean, you see all sorts of sights in there and all sorts of different people. And that was traumatic. So it was hard, like as a teenage boy growing up. And I think in terms of what that left me in, and again, I didn't know this at the time, like this was years later, I kind of put this together. But now I look back and go, you know, yeah, could an accountant or someone with finances changed everything? Maybe, maybe not. But nobody ever sat down with my dad and talked about finances and talked about money. No one ever said, Rob, why haven't you moved your prices up for the last 5 years? Like, your staff have all had pay rises. You haven't. Why aren't you taking deposits for these materials and paints that you're buying? Why are they non-refundable? You know, if they're within 2 weeks and they cancel, like, you've got a big hole in your pipeline. And, you know, why don't you charge mileage if you're travelling further away? And he did some decent stuff. He did footballers, like, houses. Like, he was really good quality-wise, but financially all over the place. And his accountant at the time was this was back in 1996, but a classic once a year. I mean, that was terrible. Here's your accounts in January. There you go. There's a tax bill. £250, please. Only here's a Christmas card. See you next year. And it was just that, what if someone could have helped him with the finances? Maybe he wouldn't have stressed as much. Maybe he wouldn't have said he could have got to say goodbye to his mum, and we would have had a bit more of a normal kind of growing up. And that's why when it comes to accountants that churn out these his year-end account 6 months after, oh, your telephone bill's gone up by a grand. So what? Like, that's why it's fueled my passion now, and I absolutely hate that once-a-year dinosaur accountant. Stems from that need that numbers and finances don't just affect that person, they really affect that family and absolutely can change lives. So that's where it all began.
Yeah, and I can see now, like, what a story. And I can see now, because you're quite fiercely opposed to the dinosaur accountant. And I know we all dislike and we know that that's the wrong thing to do, but you are very fiercely on social media, like, slamming these people, essentially, yeah. Because you've obviously seen what damage that can do to someone.
Yeah, I think, when I think about it, that's like 14-year-old Stuart lashing out, really, like, at that that status quo, if you like, and how those things are. And I've worked with people, you know, or been around, like, partners of firms that don't really care. Like, they are bothered about their money, their finances, and churning, and it being a sausage factory, and that just really does not resonate with me, like, at all. And we've all got to make money, obviously, but it's not the reason for being, as far as I'm concerned. And that's the bit, yeah, I try and work on.
When did you go into accountancy?
So I was always good at maths at school. Like, I was all maths and art. And as it happened, I was an amazing maths teacher and a not so hot art teacher. So I went down the route of, like, doing maths, business studies, and did it at university accountancy. But it was boring. It was dry as hell. And all this talk about, you know, changing people's lives, like, none of that was mentioned in university. It was financial models and debits and credits and trial balances, which, while important, you touch on them and you don't really have a clue what you're doing. And when I left uni, I said, there's no way I'm being an accountant. Like, this is an absolute snore fest. So I left. I went into retail. I went to work at Game as a manager and then Toys R Us as a retail manager for about 3 years. Again, in hindsight, the power of hindsight, although I absolutely hated Toys R Us and was so glad when that giraffe said goodbye to the world, as a learning experience, being a 21-year-old manager of 90 staff, most of them either teenagers that didn't want to be there or people that were all considerably older than me that had been doing it for years, that management experience of trying to shepherd those people, if you like, and do it with some kind of authority was a massive learning experience. And I think the same with customer service, of putting the customer first and making, like, you know, the goal there was to make the experience magical for children, ultimately, in that store.
Yeah.
And that customer perception, I think when I did then, so I did that for a few years and thought, God, I'm working crazy hours, pay's not great, and I'm not enjoying my life the way I should be. My thought was, I was really good at maths, I should be using my brain. Do you know what? I'll give an accountancy a go. So then, yeah, I applied for a range of accountancy places and had quite a few offers, and I actually went with the smallest little village practice because it just felt like the nicest environment. I had, like, top four offers, bank offers, and I went with the little village practice because one of the women there when I was sat reception was really, really, really nice. So I went with that.
Yeah, it's amazing how we make decisions with our gut like that, and they're often when we do and we follow it, as opposed to our head, it's the best decision. Can you share a couple of learnings from Toys R Us and managing all those people? Because I know you spoke about that quite fast, but I can imagine there's a like a management mentor who, she's called Marianne Page, and she taught the Go Proposal team quite a lot about leadership, and she gave me a lot of help in the early years. And her management experience comes from the shop floor of McDonald's. And one of her mantras is, like, if you can get 16-year-old boys who can't even tidy the bedroom to run one of the biggest businesses in the world, you can do anything. And it gives me that, like, that's like the experience that you've had. So tell us if you've got a couple of learnings that you can share from.
Yeah, I think there's a couple. Probably there's one around people, that classic understanding the why and believing what they're doing and making it more than a job. And the other one is probably around process-wise. So trying to instill in the guys and girls that preaching they were making Christmas magical for our children was a real thing to try and tap into, those that you try and get your tribe, so to speak, and your believers. and really getting them on side. And I think that can be a snowball effect, that like you almost get one or two people that are like, oh yeah, this sounds good, and you try and build on them and their enthusiasm and make that spread through the team. So I mean, I've done that right through my career, really. You found the people that were believers and really work on them and use them to spread the word. And then, you know, and then being brutal on the other end, those that are non-believers and never will be, get rid of them. Like, as brutal as that is, like, one toxic apple spreads so much quicker than 10 positive people. So I learned from a young age, really, management of, like, that brutality, if you like, sometimes of just calling it quits with someone and getting them out if it's not a good fit. And then the other thing was just around process, you know, where they were particularly strong was around processes and around procedures for people. So someone could start, whether they were on a shop floor, they were on the till, they were building bikes, they knew where their role started and ended. And I think the playbook, so to speak, was quite good. Although this was like before the time of like YouTube and videos, really, like it was all paper documents. It was quite a good manual in that sense. And I think, again, that's something that over the years I probably took with me in terms of actually documenting process as you go.
Yeah, definitely. Some of the best firms, accountancy firms, are run using models from other industries. So like we had a guest on yesterday who she uses the manufacturing industry to get work through essentially like a manufacturing line. And it's just taking inspiration from those industries instead of the accounting industry, which can quite often, you know, like belittle itself.
I think for a lot of people, there's a disadvantage if you go into the accountancy industry as your only ever profession and only job and only ever do that. That I think I've worked with lots of people over the years that get so wrapped up in their deadlines and their set of accounts being important, they don't see the bigger picture and the customer or client experience and things around that of people's lives. They're so embedded in this is how an accountancy practice runs. So I can totally understand that manufacturing side of things of, yeah, bringing in something from outside is incredibly powerful for making yourself different.
So you went into, which firm was it first?
So it was a local village practice.
Okay, so it wasn't UHY or Council and Legal just yet?
It was a little old place called Stiles & Co.
Nice.
In Warrington. About two partners, about 15 people at the time.
Yeah,
really small village practice.
Yeah.
Lovely people. And interesting, two different bosses that were so different, but I learned so much from. One was more of an old school dragon, like he'd scream and shout at you and he'd have a go. But at the same time, he was very caring. He bent the rules. He, you know, if he liked you, like life was good kind of thing. Like, but I think he showed me how important it was to be caring and understand when there are times when you should break the rules if someone's got something going on in their life. Like, actually, the handbook might say one thing, but he was kind of, sod it, like, go home, sort yourself out, life's good. And then the other one was the more visionary that was fantastic at implanting in me what my why was and sense of direction. And he wasn't so good at the people skills, but he was great at the vision and the strategy side of things. And together, one of them left after a few years and things changed quite dramatically there. But when they were together, that was a really powerful combination. So another learning for me now is, like, I work with a girl, Darcy, who's my right-hand woman, if you like, and I couldn't imagine doing anything without her. Like, it's that combination of those strengths and weaknesses together that are so important.
Yeah, definitely. Yin and yang. The same with me and James. Amazing. So at what point did you... Because something that's a real standout for me and you is... And you kind of touched on it already when you said about you're not... You are willing to cut people off, let people go when the time is right, when they're not adhering to the values, per se, that are being toxic. At what point in your career, just kind of give us the context for when you went into these bigger firms, so you went into UHY, you went into Accounts and Legal, and you changed things. You saw the way that they were, and you changed things, and you brought in all these great learnings from Toys R Us and the places you've been before.
So there was a fundamental moment, probably about 9 years ago now, where two things happened in the week. So when I worked at Stiles & Co, I was half decent accountant. I was a bit of a jack of all trades, so accounts, did your tax, did your bits and pieces, and I wanted to make life better, but was not the passionate, like, zealot I am nowadays. And then in a space of a week, one thing happened and that transformed my career, like, there, and then led on to UHY. And that was, I mean, it's a bit cheesy now when everyone says it, but my boss showed me the Simon Sinek, like, What's Your Why video, the 15-minute YouTube video. And literally, I watched that and everything changed from, I'm not an accountant because I'm good at solving problems and I'm good with numbers. I'm an accountant because I care about the people at the other side and I can make a difference. And that, all that story with my dad, it's like the penny dropped that moment. I watched that video and it was like, whoa, this is really powerful. I feel like I'm doing this accountancy for a different reason now, literally, in that video. And in the same week, for the first time, I went to ZeroCon, which was brand new then, and the cloud accounting world. Because back then, you know, it was once a year, it was more traditional, records were behind, it was hard to be real time. Seeing cloud accounting, and I had a conversation, funnily enough, with Helen of Futrely, which was then Crunchbowlers. Like, that was the first time I'd seen like these graphs and live reporting. I remember being on that stand, that moment going, this is the future, like, this is it. And I came back the next day and spent 2 days, like, back in the office just talking about how the practice needed to change. We needed to get cloud-based, and I just went like a crazy man for the next year to 18 months on changing what little old Styles & Co. did. And then I guess I had such an impact, I got headhunted for UHY to do something on a bigger scale, really. So I didn't go looking potentially, but yeah, it just kind of, it came around. And
amazing. So you went, when you went into UHY, what was the state of play and where did you start? Yeah. Like, where do you even start taking on a big beast like that?
So, I mean, it was a totally different kettle of fish. And I was sold a dream that was absolutely, I get why the partner did it and it was okay, but the dream that was sold to me on like signing my life away was not the reality when I turned up on the first day. So I was told, you know, you're going to run this cloud department, you got all this resource, it's going to be amazing, you know, you can roll out your apps, you can do this, it'll be fantastic. And I got there, and day one, they had only 5 clients in their entire practice that were actually on cloud. Bear in mind, I'd gone somewhere that had several hundred, like where I'd come from. And they had one bookkeeper that at the time, she doesn't now, like she's converted, but at the time she absolutely hated cloud, was because she was convinced it was going to cost her a job.
Yeah.
And that was what I went into. And it was a bit like, the first week I was like, should I go grovelling back to Styles & Co. and say, do you know what, like this isn't for me. And it was really hard. A small firm, changing culture is a doddle compared to a beast like UHY. It's like turning an oil tanker. However, UHY have got resources, they can put people on it. There are different challenges, different pros. And the managing partner, Mark Robertson, to be fair to him, put so much faith in me. In the first 3 months was a disaster there on paper. Like, we tried to push people onto cloud that didn't necessarily want to be on cloud. We worked incredibly hard. Everything overran hours-wise. Like, not one thing was under budget. Everything was over budget. There was someone who was going on a go slow, like bookkeeping wise and trying to learn process wise, and it was an absolute disaster. And it would have been easy for Mark to pull the trigger and go, this ain't working, like, see you later. But he stuck with it, credit to him. And I had a moment with one of the senior cloud managers that came in and said, Stu, you're trying to put cloud processes on top of what UHY are already doing. That will fail. Like, you need literally get you and your bookkeeper with a blank piece of paper and how it should be done on cloud process, and re-educate her and re-educate the clients on a new process. And that little piece of advice, like, I don't know, without that, I probably wouldn't have lasted 6 months. Like, that was fundamental for the change in using cloud process and scaling it. And from that moment on, we went at it in a different way. I then, like 3 months in, again, I'd worked with Darcy at Styles & Co. She followed me to UHY within 3 months. So again, I'd got my chief cheerleader and supporter as well. I'd got an ally that believed. So it was then starting to try and get people excited by it. And then absolutely, so even the tiniest win, if something came in 10 minutes under budget or a client paid 500 quid more for a forecast that they'd not done before, I was very good at screaming and shouting that to all 100 staff in that building. I was like, look how fantastic this is, guys. And I think that was a bit different for traditional partners at UHY. And I know I left a mark in that sense of being proud to be an accountant and getting people excited to be an accountant. And I think that was quite a fundamental part of shifting mindsets and getting people to believe. Mm-hmm. And then it started to, over the next 6 months, to snowball. And we'd gone from, again, when I started, if you wanted to work in cloud, you were a reject accountant. Like, you were a failed auditor you had failed your tax exams or you had nowhere else to go. I used to call us the Raggy Dolls because that was how it's perceived. And working really hard on changing that perception that actually the skill set to be a cloud accountant, yeah, it's different to an auditor, but it's not less a thing. It's something. And it was quite nice that over time you're building that excitement and importance of it, celebrating those wins to the point where there are people in the peripheries working on it that are staring in going, I quite like to do some of that. So that was kind of where I started.
And amazing.
Over what, 3.5 years scaled it. I think we had 2,000 and odd clients, team of like 15, 20 staff in the department and advisory, and a whole chunk of apps that were plugged in. So.
And how did you train? Because when you've got that many clients, you can't talk to all of them, and the partner can't talk to all of them, partners can't talk to all of them. So you must have had to train the team in having those conversations, which is a massive shift, yeah. Like probably the biggest shift of all. So how did you go about that?
Yeah, planning and using other people as much as possible. So while college and university are great for learning debits and credits, they teach you to talk, you know, in current assets, current liabilities, and 70% of business owners don't have a Scooby-Doo what that means. So I work really hard on putting some sessions on to start off. I have a little line a new trainee, anyone who starts with me new, I get them a balance sheet and I say, what's the most important number for most businesses on that number? And hopefully they'll point to net current assets or liabilities. Why is that? And they'll give me an answer that contains the word asset or liability. Tell me again, don't use that word. Like, tell me again, as I'm a five-year-old. Tell me again, as I'm a five-year-old. No, dumb it down. And I really, really work on that. Dumb it down. The word asset, the word liability are banned. And you break it down to that. And that's, I used to run, well, I still do, like hourly sessions once a fortnight on real clients of, right, here's a balance sheet, here's a P&L in small groups. What do you see? What's the story? What do those numbers tell you?
What's the right answer, by the way, to the dumbing it down? Like, what would be an ideal answer?
The net current assets is, the way I like to say it is, look, if everyone knocks on your door tomorrow and says, where's my money? If that number is positive, you can pay all them people and that's what you'll have left. If that's negative, you are short, if everyone knocks on your door, by that amount. So it's a really important number to be aware of. So that's like my little go-to. Nice. I've used that tagline for about 10 years now. I think the staff are probably sick of hearing it now. But it's nice then. And then what happens is, like, that starts with me doing that, but then other people start running training sessions, like lower down the chain, if you like, and that starts spreading down so that when new trainees start, it's not me saying that. It's so nice to earwig and hear someone else going, oh, if everyone pay, you know, if you need to pay everyone tomorrow, da da da. Like,
yeah.
It's nice to hear that regurgitated. And now, these days, now we build like our induction is it's a 2-day decent sized induction that's as much the why and that kind of stuff as it is the apps we use. So there's much more in terms of video training and support on why that's important and the things we could try and say.
And if someone didn't want to come on that journey, so say you sat these people down, you went through the sales training, you went through the, talked to them about knocking on the doors, and they were like, I didn't sign up for this shit, like, I just went to uni to talk about assets. What happens there?
Well, generally they're gone.
Yeah.
In no uncertain terms. I mean, it's rare it happens. Like, to be fair, most of the ones that come from like uni or college or studying are quite keen. They're quite excited by that, because as a rule the textbooks are a bit boring. This makes it come to life. I have more of a problem with the people that have been doing it 5-10 years that come to us that are often rabbits in the headlights, because they're like, whoa, I don't know how to speak to clients like this. Like, this feels like this advisory is up here. And it's not complicated advisory, it's basic talking through numbers, but traditional firms, only partners ever do that, and there's a definite gap on that advisory. So the biggest obstacle comes from the qualified accountants or close to that come to us that go, oh my god, I'm never going to do this. And they're definitely a 3-6 month period of, so with that, I never give someone a portfolio in the first 3 months of, like, there you go on those clients. They sit in a pod often with someone more junior than, like, above them in terms of coordinating their workflow and on calls. We do some training with them. They sit on client calls and they start by sitting on it and chipping in. Someone else leads, and over a 3-month period, they switch to becoming the leader, and their mentor then starts chipping in the other way around until they're at a point where they're comfortable with it. A hard part to train is the element of, I've done it before where I've worked with someone maybe who's doing lots of B2B and LinkedIn is maybe a useful tool for them. So they're wanting to increase sales and obviously I know that. So I'll be like, oh, use LinkedIn for this, 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 this and this. And then the trainee, they'll listen to that and then they'll go and talk to another client and they've heard that, oh, LinkedIn is good for sales. It's not relevant for that client and they'll almost try and feed that in. So that's the hardest part is almost like, you can't just listen to what I say and it's not rinse and repeat. It's really active listening and going, what is relevant to that client? But,
yeah. But
you know, I don't know if we're going to talk on the sales front. The sell me this pen routine, as cheesy as hell, is the absolute most important routine to train people to ask the right questions.
Yeah. So tell us, how do you go about it?
So yeah, whether you've been with us, it's your first day in accountancy full stop, or you've been doing this 10 years, in the first week I will do sell me this pen training with you. So it is cheesy, but the reason I do a pen and not talk about accounts is because some people don't know, you know, what a page earn is. They don't know what P11Ds are, so everyone knows how to use a pen. So when I often tell people to sell me the pen, they will start by saying, this pen is amazing. It can write on paper. It can write on plastic. It's different colours. You can use it all the time. And I'm just like, well, stop. How do you even know I want a pen? Like, what do you know I want? Like, what? So it's reset. You know, how long have you been looking for a pen? What's your budget for a pen? What do you like most about your last pen? If you change one thing about your last pen, what would it be? Is this for special occasions or regular use? It's question, and just teaching that you are not there as an accountant to provide all the answers to that. You can't fix, you know, the world's problems or indeed a business's problems yourself. You are there to ask the right questions to let often the clients solve it for themselves or work out what to do. But that only comes from a line of questioning. So the sell me this pen is like the easiest way to demonstrate that. And it's a really good way to identify who has got that naturally straight away that zones into that. And those that struggle with that, that will need more assistance and attention.
It's really clever. I know the sell me this pen is like simple and I've seen it on films and I've heard it on like webinars and things, but I've never heard it used in the context of an accountancy firm.
Yeah. No, I think it's a rare one. And I would say, you know, I am quite good at selling and quite persuasive. Like, it's one of the things I'm best at in my firm. Yeah. And I think it comes from just that constant. I'll read all the time. I'm watching videos all the time. And yeah, just that, although it is a Wolf of Wall Street, it really stuck. Actually, that works really well. And it's not a cheapy, salesy, rubbish. It's active listening to get to the bottom of a client's problem.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, everything is selling. And even when a member of the team is having a conversation that doesn't necessarily involve selling any extra product or increasing any kind of price, they're maybe just having a catch-up call. They still have to be aware that they're selling the service every single day and they're reconfirming to that client, we are the best firm, we've got you, we can look after you. And you do that by getting to the bottom of problems, helping them sort through issues that they've got in the business. So if you've not been trained in that, even in the moments when you don't feel as though you're selling anything, there's no price tag attached, you are still selling the confidence in your service.
Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah, it's brilliant. When you left UHY, what state was it in? What had changed?
So it was night and day in terms of like the cloud function. Like I say, it'd gone from 5 clients to a few thousand. And I was then running also like nationally. I was the chair of the UHY for the 23 firms in terms of their cloud offering. So again, I could pick out on one hand how many cloud clients each firm had when I started, and they were all well into the hundreds, if not thousands, by the time I'd gone. And can't take full credit for that. That was a big part of steering that and driving it and changing it. And it was great. And there was a nice app stack. It just got to a point where I think when you're employed, like the way I like to look at it is these things are projects for so many years and you can make that impact. And then you decide whether, like in year one, I go from maybe 0 to 50 out of 100. Year two, it's 50 to 75. Year three, it's 75 to 85. And though that impact you make almost gets kind of like less and less, if you like, as you're squeezing more and more juice out of what's there. And it's almost more self-sufficient then. I do try and make places where I am not a bottleneck and I am not like, I could walk away and life continues. So I think I'd got it to a point where I could have squeezed a bit more out of it, but I'd done the vast majority of it. There were a few partners there that probably weren't as keen, and I thought, I don't want to spend my life trying to persuade them that real time's the future, or let them just retire and,
yeah,
you know, with their list of clients, if you like. And it was like, yeah, you know what, that's okay. An opportunity came up with Accounts and Legal. Like, it was a random LinkedIn message that caught me on a really good day. And it sounded interesting in terms of like being able to set up a Manchester office. Again, a bit more of a project to start from the ground up. And I just thought, yeah, you know what, like it's time for the next challenge, so to speak, and to go for it.
And was accounts and legal in a similar state as UHY, or were they a little bit, because you're a few years further on?
Yeah, it was different. So it had clients and it existed. I had a London office and a Brighton office, and it was doing a million or so turnover. So it was pure cloud. In that sense, it was better. But in terms of process and structure, like, it was where UHY was strong was around structure and processes. Everything had rules, and Accounts and Legal had none.
Yeah.
It was a bit of a free-for-all, and I think Accounts and Legal were always fantastic and still are at the website, the SEO, the driving clients there. Certainly when I started looking at the London operation, there were huge holes in that bucket. So as fast as it was coming in, like, it was losing work. And if you look at the Google reviews and the Trustpilot before 2019 and after it, like, there's a distinct shift, if you like, in terms of the level of service and what was happening. And I think the crucial thing I brought, well, one, I opened the Manchester office, and that was different because it was scaling from scratch. But I brought in this concept of a quarterly catch-up as standard, where they pay us 100 quid a month or £1,000, £2,000 a month. Everyone has a quarterly catch-up of some description as standard. And I think that was quite different, and has made clients really, really sticky as a result. Meant a lot of change. Been a lot of, like, there's two phases to this, because I grew the Manchester and Liverpool office and did that separately, if you like. And then I took over 12 months or so ago, MD role across all firms. But that meant quite a significant restructure to the way that London worked, because the way that was functioning was not the same as the way the Manchester office was functioning.
Yeah.
And that was tough. That was having to get the knife out and get a bit bloody, which was horrible. But if I didn't make that change, like, it wouldn't have survived as strong, but it wouldn't have been the thing I wanted it to be. And I cannot ever stand in front of someone and say we are X, Y, and Z, and know in the background that we're not. Yeah, we all drop batons. We all have clients that fall out with us, or we make mistakes, but we never intentionally sell something that we're full well we're not going to deliver it. And that was becoming an issue with the London office that needed correcting. So
how did you, the reviews were really low and you put in the quarterly catch-ups, which sounds great, but when it's money versus resource versus money versus time, how did that work? Was there a lot of repricing that had to go on?
Well, it was twofold. So when I started in Manchester, like, that was an open book. Me and Darcy started 3.5 years ago. No clients. Like, win your own clients. Off you go. Used go proposals from day one with a pricing structure that was there or thereabouts. It's been tweaked over time, like it should be, but the basic, this is your price for account, this is your price for VAT return, there was a marker in to cover that catch-up and that kind of work. So generally speaking, that saw pretty reasonable growth that was quite profitable. Like, me and Darcy were on decent salaries. The plan was to be loss-making for 18 months for that office, and we got to break even in 9, and that was the power of proper pricing, I would say, from day one. And, you know, I do preach about that. So in that sense, it was okay. It was structured. There was a lot of work that went into forecasting the hires. Like, I am a big believer in forecasting in your own business and your own numbers, and we did that in the Manchester office. Quite detailed, so we'd have weekly. I love Traction. The book Traction by Gina Wickman is just the greatest book ever written. So we would have weekly meetings with a weekly scorecard, looking at the drivers, and that was things like LinkedIn posts, networking events for sales, but then also like health scores at 100% on the apps that we use to see that quality was okay, that kind of stuff. So we had a range of things that we monitored, but from day one, there or thereabouts, the price was right, and that grew really nicely, organically, and ultimately through the power of my social media, really, for the most part. It was different in terms of the London offering. Like that, they weren't on Gold Proposal. Like they had clients that were vastly different. They had this online package that was £90 a month, but it just it didn't stack up in terms of what was paid for versus what was done. And I also think, I've gone off a bit of a tangent here now, but just thinking out loud, when I hired people in Manchester, they got the Gold Proposal training, they got to sell me this pen in week one, and they got the every single one of those people from day one, sales was part of their job. Sales is not a dirty word. You are all involved in the selling and the repricing. So on every quarterly catch-up, that squad were repricing and having difficult conversations to say, you know what? You know, I always say it's like petrol with bookkeeping. If your transactions have gone up, you've got to pay more. You wouldn't go to the petrol station and get twice as much and pay the same price. Like you're paying for quantity. And it's that concept. So they were on board and they were financially rewarded. So they get a commission as well. If a fee goes up by £100 a month, they get half of the first month that it's gone up. So they'll get £50 for that because it's
like that.
Because it's not enjoyable, like, and it's not, you know, a core part of their job, but it's essential, so let's reward it. So in that sense, they were from day one doing catch-ups and life was good. Where it was tricky was in London, where, yeah, the pricing was all over the place. Scope creep was rife, so you tended to get two types of client. You got clients that probably weren't paying very much, but the service was a once a year or a light touch point, so they weren't that bothered, it kind of fit. Or they weren't paying very much, but they were getting management accounts, they were getting calls as when they wanted it. Like, it was insane the level that some people were running around for the price.
Where did you begin? Where do you start?
Yeah, so it was...
And just before we get into it, how many clients are we talking? How many staff in this London office?
So, in the London office, there were about 20 staff.
Yeah.
In total, there was 600 clients across the board, yeah. Of which probably 350 maybe were London clients.
And what are the kind of average fees?
So the average fee in London was about £150 a month.
Okay, so not
much at all.
Not many big hitters.
No. There was the odd big hitter, but even that, well, there was the odd big hitter in terms of time, but not in terms of price.
Yeah. The clients that you had, were any of them, because obviously the Liverpool and Manchester office are quite new. How long had this office been going?
The London one?
Yeah.
Probably for about 7 years.
So was there a lot of legacy going on, a lot of clients that... It had just been that way for years, so people didn't want to reprice them because...
Yeah, like yeah. There's a lot, yeah, certainly 3 years plus that had been there.
Okay.
And that was what they were used to and that was what they got. And
yeah.
So in some, you know, for some it was a cheap and cheerful service and that was okay for what they wanted to pay and what they wanted to do. But I'm not a cheap and cheerful accountant and didn't want to run a practice that was cheap and cheerful. So that needed to change. But it was hard. So the first step here... As painful as it was to get our practice manager software that held. So in our practice manager software, we have got like accounts fee, bookkeeping fee, management account fee. Those are all split in a similar way so they match Gold Proposal's key areas. They don't have as much detail. So like your Gold Proposal have your bookkeeping like line by lines. This just had one, but it gives enough for each service. And as painful as it is, we put that into a spreadsheet, a monster spreadsheet with like 600 odd lines. And it was, that's the fee at the moment. And then... in October, we asked every single person in the building, so not just in London, but every single person in the building, rerun your clients through Gold Proposal. You've got 2 weeks to do it. Fill that spreadsheet with what the number should be. So that was a 2 week period, and that showed us like what the shortfall was on income.
And what were like some of the big numbers?
It was excruciating. The worst cases were some that were paying £300 a month that should be a grand and a half.
Yeah.
There were a fair few four-figure gaps per month, that is, not per year, that is per month. On average, you were probably talking 100, 200 quid. Like, most were out by. There weren't many that were out by. Most were out by more than 10%.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we had a monster list to work with, and then we colour-coded that with, like, red, if they were significantly out, amber, if they were 10 to 50% out, which is still quite horrendous, and green if they were 10% or less out.
And when you say 10% or less, oh, sorry.
Oh, fees. If it was 100 quid, yeah, sorry, yeah. And it was 110, that was green.
Yeah.
They were only 10% out. If it was between 10 and 50%, so still quite a chunk.
Yeah, yeah.
They were amber, and if it was more than a 50% increase, they were in the red zone. So.
Did you start with the reds?
Yeah.
And
well, we did. Well, that's what should have happened. But what was interesting is so each manager was tasked with repricing and filling the spreadsheet in it. So it was a monster spreadsheet that had a client name, what it should be, what the services are, date of next catch-up. So it was like, we're getting these quality catch-ups in and this is the date. And then we had January, February, March, April, May, like at the side with where the fee was and where it should be. So we could map out, like forecasting what it will be over the coming months. And what was really interesting with some of the people there, it was like, why is it going down, not up? And that they were doing the ones, there was the odd one that went down, not many, but they were, that they were all getting done straight away. And the ones that were the difficult conversations were, oh, they didn't turn up for that catch-up. Oh, I'll do it later. I'll do that, yeah. And obviously, we're doing this in November when we started rolling it out once the pricing was done. We're getting close to Christmas and it was like, really need this done this side of Christmas, not afterwards. So really working with particular people on like, you need to book these in. And there was definitely an element of micromanagement and an element of, is this the right place for you if you don't want to do these catch-ups? So it was hard, but it was being strategic. We had weekly meetings, and then the GoProsal guys had check-ins every week with us as well. Like they came on the call, so there was a third party that kept us accountable.
That's
And then everyone, that was like the number one KPI, is like number of catch-ups, number of fees, what the number should be. And it was just that weekly check-in through November and December to really, really, really be absolutely all over it. So it was hard, but we did it, got through it. There were lots of grumbles, you know, from client. I understand it. Like if I was a client paying 300 quid and someone, you were going to tell me it was 1200 quid, I might be a bit, say what? So again, we had to stage the big ones. So again, James Bashard is a wonderful human being and the don of pricing. But I think sometimes it's all right to say, don't give discounts or that's the price and tough. The reality is if all those clients would have said no, we'd have gone bust. Like that was such a huge shift that there had to be an element of, okay, like, we're going to have to place a little bit differently and a bit carefully. So one of our absolute biggest clients was a bit of a pain, to be honest, was a bit of a pitter, but we couldn't get rid of them because they were such a big fee. Like it was like, they're going to have to stay for 6 months and we're going to have to overservice them a little bit because it's just such a fundamental part of that portfolio. So that one stayed for six more months untouched because it was just such a big number anyway. And then the other ones were, look, it's the conversation kind of went, look, it's 300 quid now. Should be 1200. I know that's really hard to take. Tell you what, we'll move it up in stages over 3 to 6 months, depending on the amount. And instead of getting a quality catch up, do you know what? I am going to personally be on a catch up with you. I am going to see you every month for 3 months because you've not had value. You've not had a £1,200 service. I'm going to show you what it looks like. If you want to stick with us after that, great. If you don't, no problem. But give us a chance to show you what you're missing. And most of the biggest increases went, go like, okay, then we'll, you know, I mean, it was a charm offensive. Like, it was me and Sylvia that were the chief salespeople / you know, charmers that were really, really trying our best to do what we could to pull out all the stops. And the vast majority of those chunky increases stayed on as a result of that. But I think if we had just gone 300 quid, it should be 1200, yeah, they would have just gone, nah, forget it, see you later.
So what would you say to someone then listening who, a lot of firms listening to this right now will need to go through this process, even if they're not as kind of far back as the London office was, though somewhere will have to do lots of repricing. But say there's only one or two people in the practice and they don't feel they have that sales skill, what would you do?
I would say two things on that. One is, so we had like you could put it off forever and ever and ever. So like make a definitive plan of action that we had 3 months that we're going to have. The prices were all going to move to the full in 3 months, but everyone was going to have a conversation and we were going to say, look, it needs to move. So you've got to set a realistic time frame, and I would say no more than three, unless you've got thousands and thousands of conversations, no more than 3 months as a maximum to get around them. Otherwise, you'll put it off. Break that down into weekly, like what that will be, number of conversations for starters. And if you're not confident, I would start with whichever clients you think you've got the best relationship with that like you naturally, where you can, you know, I remember one, I made a joke that McDonald's cheeseburgers are going up by 50 pence. Like, this is the way of the world. We've got to do it to keep going. And I wouldn't have said that to a client that I couldn't, like, didn't like me, if you like, that I couldn't joke with. But as daft as that was, I knew a sense of humour around it would work with some of those people. So start with the clients that you think you've got the strongest relationships with. And if you're really not sure, then start with the £10 increase, just for a few. Like, I'm not saying ignore the big ones, but first five, yeah, all right, start with the £10, the £20 increase is the easy ones, because, again, originally when some of the managers were doing it, they were saying all the wrong things to start with. So if you have got a team and you're doing it, like, get on calls with them, mentor it, record the sessions, like record the catch-ups, and provide feedback as soon as physically possible on what could have been better about it. And even watch your own back. Like, although I hate my slightly mank twang, I have watched a fair few of mine back, especially when I know it's not... I know a catch-up or a recall where I'm like, ugh, I could have done that better. And I would say within 24 hours, watch it back. Mm-hmm. Pen and paper.
I really struggled.
Oh, that was I said that bit wrong, or yeah, in the wrong order. Because it will hone your craft. But if you never do it, if you put it off and put it off, like, you will never get any better.
Yeah.
And then obviously hopefully you'll have new prospects coming in at the time and use all those tools from the word go. So, you know, you can work on your sales pattern and that then. And probably the last thing on this is stories. You know, every new client has heard that story about my dad at the start of this podcast. Like, I tell them that, of why their finances are important, and stories sell. So even framing the reprice in a story is a really powerful way of getting the client to understand why that needs to be done, as opposed to just on outcomes. So yeah.
Yeah, that's important. Because as well, a lot, obviously doing this as a job and interviewing a lot of business owners in the accountancy world, a lot of people went into the industry because of difficulties with money. And this, whether it's completely consciously and on purpose or subconsciously, this helps them to be like in control of numbers. And so everyone's going to have a story.
Yeah. Even whether it's your own story or client stories, you know, we've had all sorts of client stories, whether it's tax that we've saved, the messes they've been in with HMRC, stressful nights. You know, we had one client that fell downstairs and died. And like, just in terms of the protection for his company and what that meant to his wife, like, it's a horrible story. But it's a story that needs to be shared to help other people not get into those messes. So it doesn't even need to be your own story. Like, you'll have hundreds of client stories, and without naming those clients, that you can bring in to show other people like why these things are needed.
So what were the results?
So the results were, we lost 150 clients over 3 months. So
from
600 to 450 in total firm-wide. Yeah. So it decimated the list of clients. But the monthly income went up by £10,000 a month. So 120 grand a year. So 150 less clients, 120 grand more in the bank. So
the dream.
Yeah. So, and in just in terms of that made this whole quality catch-up suddenly possible then. Like, you're freeing time, you're allowing people to deliver a service that at a level that you want, as opposed to them running around like mad men or women to try and service, you know, a crazy size of portfolio. So I think, yeah, income went up. But I would also say, like, staff satisfaction increased and client service, like, as a result. Like, it's no coincidence that the reviews for Accounts and Legal after that period got significantly better, if you look back, than before it, even though clients are paying more. And interestingly, we did a client survey about 3 months after the repress. This was this summer. And the more you pay us, the more you like us. Anyone who pays us £800 a month or more, 5 stars, would recommend us to everyone and everybody, absolutely love us. Anyone that pays 400 would give us 4.5 stars and he's quite keen. Anyone less than that, it's a bit more, yeah, you're good, but it's kind of a 4.5, 4 star. And it's really interesting that the more they pay, the more they like us. So
they value you and you can, yeah. I'd imagine the client base would just, I don't want to say better quality, because I'm sure some of the people you lost were great businesses, but just better to work with. More appreciative of your services, but more appreciative of like how important financial services are for the business, and so your team would feel more, I don't know, powerful in their job.
Yeah, and they're adding more value, as cheesy again as that sounds. And I think some clients didn't realise, you know, those that were just serviced like through that sausage factory, oh, I didn't know you could help me with cash flow forecasting, or we haven't talked about budgets, we haven't talked about my, you know, next year's plan. It gave us time to do those things. So the other thing was like one-off income increased as well by the best part of 25% per month as well. That there was more spin-offs to, oh, we can help with that, we can help with that, we can help with that. And we've got time to do it now. So
have you got any thoughts for, like, because all this is well and good, but a lot of firm owners are very deeply emotionally invested in their clients. And so they will struggle emotionally to reprice these clients, whether they've taken over a parent's firm and they don't want to, like, piss off the parents by losing these clients. Like, have you got any thoughts for those guys? Because even UHY and Accounts and Legal, because they're, like, relatively big companies, you still don't have, like, the owners there, do you? You've got partners.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So it just adds that barrier of emotion, takes the emotion out of it a little bit. Have you ever come across that as a problem? And, like, what advice have you got there?
Yeah, I mean, I'm probably going to pinch something that you say, to be honest, on the whole, that element of what's being nice and what's being kind kind of philosophy. Like, is it in the client's best interest to pay you less, where you can't deliver the service that you want, you can't help them in the way that you want to, would be the way I would come at it. That in order to help them to full capacity, they have to pay the right price for you to be able to do that, whether that's you or your team for the right amount. And if you don't, one of two things happens. Either they do get over-serviced, but you end up, you know, losing sleep, working crazy hours and can't expand yourself. So for your own well-being and mental health, life is difficult. Or what often happens is they don't get serviced. They get serviced at the level that they pay in. It's not what they really need. You know, I go back to people like my dad. They get serviced like that, car crash happens, and you can't save them. You know, there's some crazy stats. Huge percentage of businesses don't last 5 years. And you can have, do you want a relationship for so long that's going to last, and it might die if the company goes bust or struggles financially, or one where if they'd have paid a bit more, you know what, you might have been able to keep them on track and actually lasted a bit longer with them. Mm-hmm. But it is tricky. Like, there is a human element to it, for sure. And it's why there is leniency, and it might not be a discount, but there is an element of, we can stage a fee, we can work together to meet in the middle to see where things lie, so to speak.
Because it is ultimately the responsibility of the firm that you've let this get so far out of scope. Because, of course, your client's not going to come to you and go, I think I'm not paying you enough. Yeah, it's very rare.
Yeah.
So you do have to take a bit of accountability. And I love what you said about showing them first. Like, I know £1,200 is a massive jump from £300, but let me show you what we can do for that money, because you need it and it's my responsibility to show you.
Yeah, that's the biggest. Certainly on those big rises, that's the biggest way of getting it over the line. Like, even the concept of what is a management account, like, I encourage the guys and girls, if they think there's a client that would benefit, but they're not biting, give it to them for free for a month. Like, give them a free month and then go, this is you know, this is what you could have won, so to speak. And it's rare that a client will go, oh, go on then, I'll go back to where I was. That they do want to take it. Mm-hmm. But again, the guys and girls have got that. It is that sales mindset. They're looking for those opportunities to help those clients, knowing that paying more is a good thing. You know, we have a big thing when we do the fee reviews. If it's not changed, we tell them it's not changed as well every quarter. And originally people were saying, oh, good news, your fee's not changed. That's not good news. That's bad news. Like, you're not growing. If you pay me the same, you're not growing. You stay the same, or you shrank. It's worse if you pay me less. Like, so even that mindset of actually bad news, stay the same. You want to be paying me more, because it means your numbers are going in the right direction. You're earning more money. Who would not want to do that?
And how often do you do the reviews? So how often will they get those emails?
So every quarter, as part of the quarterly catch-up, the fee, it's like, we'd never email it out. It's always like human. I love the eye-to-eye contact of, like, I'm going to tell you to your face, like, what this number is. I don't like the idea of just email it out.
Which is what a lot of people shy away from.
Yeah.
Because they don't have the courage to go and have that conversation face-to-face. So they're like, well, I've got to do it, so I'll send them an email and hopefully they'll just see it and click yes.
Yeah.
But that's not reality, is it?
No. And for me, even if it's a 5% increase, like, even if it's inflation one, like, it's the way of email is not the way to do it. Like, it just Not when, if you're a huge organisation with thousands and thousands, you know, like cloud apps, yeah, fair enough, you can't phone every single client up, I get that, but when we're talking, we've got a few hundred clients, you've got the, there is someone that has a relationship in that organisation with every person, you know, there is a client manager to every single one of them clients, they've got a relationship with that person, it should be that person should be able to pick the phone up or get on a catch up, and at the end of it go, review your numbers, this is where it's at, and I think that's really important, and you can, you know, handle objections on what that is, and I think some people might question price, but it's getting you often hear symptoms as opposed to what the problem is on with regard to that price increase, and you can't get to the bottom of what the real issue is via an email, and even if they respond back via email, it gets so lost in translation, the tone, and was that said in a mood, was that said in jest, like. Whereas when I look at you eye to eye and say, oh, it's going up by 100 quid, I will know instantly from how you look at me on how you've taken that. And for me, that's really, really important. So the reviews are every quarter. And again, we've got a slight difference from the GP like methodology that would say, we do payroll every month, VAT returns, bookkeeping every quarter. Yeah, I know generally people say, oh, you look at the year-end accounts and do it every year. I would say do that every quarter as well. Like, so we... If the turnover's close to a bracket and it's just moved over, all right, you can say, do you know what? You've moved over, but we're going to hold it till the year end. But you get some clients. I mean, we had one that went from £100,000 to £6 million in a very short space of time.
Yeah, yeah.
If we would have left that, like that, there was hundreds and hundreds of pounds left on the table. So I'd even say if they're a rocket to the moon, like everything should be getting reviewed every quarter, not even those things that are yearly, because things change.
So thank you for that, Stuart. So what does the future look like for you?
So in terms of the next adventure, I think in terms of what I've done at Accounts and Legal and where it's at, I've left it in a good place and a place where it can carry on without me. I'm going to have a bit of downtime, a bit of chance to recuperate. I'm doing some work with some of the app stack to help there. Also with working with other accountants, well, with the legend that is Rachel Harris, actually over the last 6 months, I've realised that I actually quite enjoy working with other accountants as well and helping them get more out of it. So I used to be quite anti, you know, oh, this dinosaur accountant and accountants generally. And I've realised that while there are dinosaurs out there, there are lots of people that are struggling. They might be wanting, but they want to improve services. But it's really hard where to start, whether that's pricing, service, process, app stack. And I think with nearly 20 years experience, like I can help a lot of people there. And that's a good way of helping businesses. So I'm doing a bit of work to help other accountants, and I'll probably do something in terms of setting up a practice of some description to keep my eye in. Like, I don't want to kind of like coach and not be in it. So a bit like Della Hudson runs a practice and coaches, I'll probably do something along those lines. But that's still all very fresh. And at the moment, we're about 7 days from Christmas, and I'm looking forward to going into a cottage in Wales for 3 days, chilling out and a bit of downtime, and then assess what
2024
will bring.
Just an incredible, like, three different projects and stories you've had with firms. I know everyone listening will have got so much value, to use that word again, from this. Like, lots of practical advice. So thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, no problem. Absolute pleasure. And, you know, just know as an employee, like, you can still have, like, a huge impact at your firm. And I'd say see it as a project, see it as a 3-year, 5-year plan, and you can change the world from the inside, so to speak. You don't need to be running a business to make massive changes in the industry.
100%, and I can vouch for that. And I think even on the flip side, I can vouch for that because I was that person in Go Proposal. But on the flip side, as a business owner, find that person. Like, who is your ops manager? Who is the... You can't do this alone. So who is the person in your company? Forget about age, forget about experience. Who's the person who is like smashing all of your core values? If you could clone them, you would. They are like the yin to your yang, and they could help you like light a fire under your firm, and find them and nurture them, give them opportunities, promote them, increase the pay and challenge them. Like, give them a challenge, like the challenge that you've been given.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a lot of great people working in places that probably don't get the opportunity or are suppressed a bit. And, you know, I come back to market your HY, you give me the blank piece of paper, open opportunity, and went, go for this. Like, I believe in you. You make the change. I'll fight your battles. I'll empower you at board level. Go for it. And without having someone like that, yeah, like it's difficult. So yeah, for business owners, find those people in the firm and absolutely empower them.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.